David A. Price presents...
Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 297. I'm your host, Steve Raker, making noise at you from the comic book bunker. Marvel Noise is a podcast proudly sponsored by nobody. We're part of the Deliberate Noise Network. You can find episodes new and old over on marvelnoise.com, and you can reach us on our Facebook page or via Twitter. This episode, Kevin Whirlwind X and Andrew the LA Rabbit will join me to delve into issues 85 to 92 of Power Man and Iron Fist on our mission to get to issue 100 of that title. But first, I got just a couple of quick recent reads to share with you. One, I've been keeping up with the Secret Empire event that's currently going on throughout the Marvel Universe that has Captain America, his history, and Foundation rewritten by the Cosmic Cube, and has joined Hydra, has been part of Hydra all along, and now he's enacting his plan and taking over the world. At first, I wasn't too excited with the premise of this event in reading the Captain America title, although it has its cleverness to it. I wasn't particularly enjoying going the amount of real estate that was used for the flashbacks, going back to kind of retconning Steve's history. I felt like that was, complete storytelling, that it was a lot of filler to kind of getting to the main event, which I was happily surprised with. When the Zero issue and the first issue hit the stands, I was pleasantly surprised at how much I enjoyed seeing the tactician aspect of Captain America put into play in sort of an evil way, kind of in like in a, I guess it's Marvel's version of Batman doing the, he had that satellite that had everybody's weaknesses in it or something, didn't he? Kind of the Xavier protocols of the regular Avengers part of the Marvel Universe, because Cap had a pretty clever way to pull a lot of strings all at once to set himself up and his Hydra cronies. And who the inner circle of Hydra cronies are kind of entertaining. But then, with the second issue, I really felt like the series took a big dive on the coolometer. Part of it, I admit, was that as much as I like Andrea Sorrentino's artwork on other titles that I've seen, on the big event book, I don't know, I really wasn't... Even the palette of the book, it really wasn't capturing my eye visually, but I was interested in the concept and the story, so I wanted to see where it was going, but it quickly turned into the kind of almost every other event where they make a whole... It was like all of a sudden House of M or Age of Apocalypse, where now there's a new reality sort of in play and everything's different. I don't know. It started to seem more cliched than unique, even if the uniqueness wasn't necessarily up my alley to begin with. But so now with the third issue, I think we're moving back to somewhat closer to some neutral ground on the old coolometer, because now it, again, sort of a cliched event trope, is they are now... the heroes, the resistance, are on a quest to collect shards of the... And does it sound like Superhero Squad, the old little cartoon with the little Smurf-sized superhero figures? No, that was a pretty funny show, that tune. Superhero Squad! Hero. Superhero Squad! Hero. Superhero Squad! But yeah, they have to go and find the shards of the broken Cosmic Cube. When they assemble them, they can potentially get our Cap back. So now it's a race to get to the different shards, and they can break up into little groups and have to see who can get there first, and we'll see. I'll keep reading, and I'll keep reporting back what I think about it, hopefully more coherently than this time. Another book I read and was really pleasantly surprised by both with the first arc and then finished, which I had read a while ago, and then finishing off the whole series just recently, and that is the recent Carnage series, written by Jerry Conway, with art by Mike Perkins. 16 issues. As I'm reading along, first I got kind of that Ridley Scott Alien vibe, because it's Carnage in almost as the lone force of nature in a couple of different settings. In the first arc, he's in a mine, like an abandoned mine, and you know, then there are other people in the mine with Carnage. The second arc has him on a boat at sea. First a little fishing boat, then a cruise ship. Again, abandoned. Well, wasn't abandoned, but after he kills everybody on the boat, and he's the only one on it, then it's abandoned, right? And then at the end arc, on an island. And it reminded me of the old Alien. It's the haunted house thing, right? There's something in the house with you. And that's really what I loved about that first Alien movie, too. It was the haunted house in outer space. The being that they encountered was so, dare I say it, alien, from the reproductive cycle to the blood even being acidous and burning through all the hull in the ship and potentially, you know, breaching the hull to outer space kind of thing. Every aspect of it was an unknown and was a danger. And there was just one of it and a whole bunch of people, and we were the ones who were outnumbered, the humans, if I can identify myself with them. Then in the later movies, it was almost like it was more of a hive thing, like quantity over quality. I didn't like the idea that if you had six bullets in your gun, you could kill six aliens with it. I liked when it was one that was such a, again, force of nature to deal with. And that's the vibe I was getting from this book. But then as the supporting cast started to develop by the end of the second arc, when they're out at sea, Sea Devil, it was called, I started to get this, almost a Tomb of Dracula vibe to it, where it was focusing more on the supporting cast and them having to chase down Carnage. Jerry Conway and Perkins each wrote little text pieces at the end of the last issue, the 16th issue, and they'd confirm that it is basically supposed to be Tomb of Dracula without the tomb and without the Dracula, almost with Carnage as Dracula being the force of nature that cast is having to hunt down. And what's funny is that with Jerry Conway at the helm, he's also the one who helped to develop the Tomb of Dracula series before it was handed off to Marv Wolfman, who, let's face it, really ran with the concept. But here we have this team of kind of monster hunters in pursuit of a creature. And I'm not much of a Carnage fan, but he was used well here, I have to say. The squad of Venom hunters that are assembled by this FBI agent, female, who's like this anti-Carnage task force person assigned to lead this squad, she gathers folks such as Eddie Brock, the former Venom wearers, basically. John Jameson, he's got the Man-Wolf thing, so we get to see Man-Wolf, and who wrote the original Man-Wolf story? It's Jerry Conway. So that's pretty cool. He's coming back to that character. Brock is Toxin, though. I thought he was anti-Venom, but I guess he's Toxin since then. Another color scheme. And then the other aspect of this series is a strong Darkhold. The Darkhold has a hold on the series. And again, who created the Darkhold? Back in, what was it, Marvel Spotlight? The Werewolf by Night stuff in Marvel Spotlight, I think it was, back in the early 70s. Jerry Conway's the one who wrote a lot of that early Marvel mysticism and created the Darkhold and C'thon and all that sort of stuff. And so Darkhold, in the beginning, the FBI agent and her squad chase Carnage into this mine, and they're going to trap him there, but he finds the Darkhold book and escapes with it. And then the Darkhold starts getting its tendrils into Carnage and starts using Carnage as its agent of destruction and kind of leading him on this quest to find this island that is the Darkhold Island that has all these secrets in it and a temple and a ceremony that must take place. Of course, there will be a blood sacrifice. and then Kathan or Shathan or however you guys like to say it. It's one of those comic book Lovecraftian type words that you see read more than you hear said. Kathan is going to come to life, and he does, so heroes should be a little quicker next time. Victoria Montesi is there because of the Darkhold. She ends up leading this anti-carnage task force after the FBI agent becomes a new symbiote, Raze. We're going through all the symbiote tropes here, but we've got Victoria Montesi, we've got the little Darkhold murder midget from the Darkhold series, the Book of the Darkhold, Midnight Suns, and that gets even referenced back from the 90s. If you go back and listen to Marvel Noise episode 164 from February 2012, Tom Morris and I give a little history lesson on the Midnight Suns. What was it? I guess you could call it a publishing initiative at the time. It was a whole corner of the Marvel Universe. And you guys know how to use MarvelNoise.com to find the old episodes. You go over on the right-hand side. There's a little column. There's a little calendar down there. And you can do a little drop menu and go right to February 2012 and find episode 164. So the Darkhold leads Carnage to this island and temple and all that stuff, and it has a satisfactory, horror-esque Tomb of Dracula-ish vibe and outcome that, I guess, kind of puts everybody in place to go on to either reconnect with the regular Marvel Universe and kind of the Spider-Man universe, like in Eddie Brock's case, or go off to be ready for another tale to be told if this, collection sells well. But it's definitely worth checking out, especially if it's on Marvel Unlimited, which I didn't confirm before starting to make noise. And lastly, before we get to the Power Man and Iron Fist stuff, I read She-Hulk 1, well, I guess it's Hulk, right? Hulk 1 through 6 of the new series. As much as I love Jennifer Walters and the She-Hulk character in general, this was a little disappointing, this title. Written by Mariko Tamaki, with art by Nico Leon, and colors by Matt Miller. There are aspects of the art that I liked. I didn't particularly care for a lot of the lavenders and purples in the color palette. I know that purple and green sort of ended up being, you know, the Hulk colors, if you will, but I like it when it stands out on the Hulky aspect of things. That's the Hulk that's the purple and the green, and not the whole rest of the world that he's encountering. And I guess you could do that in this book, but there's just not enough Hulk, or She-Hulk in this case, to give you it there. In this first six issues, the deconstructed arc, we have Jen Walters being set up in a new status quo of being a lawyer as a in her human form. And she doesn't really become the Hulk, She-Hulk, until the last part of the arc. While the drama and the intrigue of her cases is enough to carry the story along, really the pacing, and you need to pepper in the car chase or the action scene throughout each issue, rather than all at the end of the first arc. This is felt like early 2000s storytelling where it was written for the trade. I'm not sure if this series is going on beyond this, but the journey of Jen Walters is odd here. When she's transforming into the She-Hulk, she almost looks like a different design She-Hulk. She's not exactly giant and savage, but she is kind of growling, and she's got glowing tribal marks on her. Like, the design almost makes me think like it's like New 52 She-Hulk, or even again, to go to a Warner Brothers thing, like the Injustice 2 video game that's hot right now, like with the design with all those glowing lines on everybody with all their different gear and stuff. That's what She-Hulk's glowing eyes and glowing tribal marks and with the messed up hair and stuff, and her haunched, they have her kind of in the shadows. She almost looks like the original Slayer from the old Buffy the Vampire show. When she would have the visions of her and stuff. So I will read if it keeps going on, because I am fond of the character and there is enough that's intriguing to see if they are going to try to continue to tell stories in this manner. But we'll see. All right. And with that rambling, let's get to the Power Man and Iron Fist stuff and bring the guys on. right, we're back for Power Man and Iron Fist. We're finally up to issues 85 to 92, which ran from the summer of 1982 to winter, around February, I think, of 1983. Although it's probably got like an April cover date or something. 60 cents an issue. Titles published monthly. We have gone through from Archie Goodwin to Len Wein, Tony Isabella, Don McGregor, Marv Wolfman, Chris Claremont, Ed Hannigan, Mary Jo Duffy, and then editor Denny O'Neill took over the writing chores after Mary Jo Duffy. And tonight we're picking up on the last few issues of Denny's run before he steps back into his editor role, and we have a young gun in Kurt Busiek starting his first writing gig on the title, and he starts getting his feet under him. So that next segment, which will probably be episode 299 of Marvel Noise, we can go from 93 right up to issue 100. The big 100.
Who doesn't like 100 issues? If you want, you can go back and pull up Marvel Noise episode 100 and hear your take on Power Man and Iron Fist 100.
Oh, man. How about that? I should do that, shouldn't I? That's funny. Also, you can read along. Issues 85 through 89, at least, are on both the Marvel Unlimited digital service and in trade paperback form in the last Epic collection. But after that, you're on your own for 90, 91, and 92. And with O'Neill now doing the writing, Denny has Ralph Macchio. Not that Ralph Macchio.
The Karate Kid?
Right. Pulling editor duty. And I forgot to look to see if Ralph was Denny's assistant editor, so it was merely just an in-office type situation or not. But anyway, for issue 85, we have Denny O'Neill writing with Keith Pollard and Dave Simmons on the art chores. Let me just say, guys, Pollard Simmons for president. I really like this art team.
I do, too. I was not familiar with Dave Simmons, though.
Oh, my God. I love Dave Simmons. He passed way before his time, I believe sometime in the 80s when I was still reading books in the mid-80s or late 80s, maybe. But he would do a fill-in issue or a cover or do the inks on an issue of, like, Defenders or a fill-in issue of something, and it would be like, wow, this is great, and it's Dave Simmons or a Marvel team-up thing. Or he did the Ghost Rider-ish of Team America. And even that one was, I mean, that was the great issue of that series, because it's like Dave Simmons doing Ghost Rider and the Team America Marauder guy or whatever. But anyway, I love Dave Simmons stuff. And a nice Carl Potts cover, too, as Mr. Potts starts making his mark on the Marvel Universe, both behind the desk and as a freelancer.
I love on the splash that the heavy perspective. I always like when they have that. You can see the point, and it all collapses down. I don't know why I like that so much.
And how cool is Simmons's inks on Luke's like shirt sleeves and stuff? I love it. The faces and the musculature and everything. It's so good. So anyway, Luke and Danny on their way to meet with an employer. An employer's got a sweet government contract, but this out of control truck slams into a building, and you know, there's injured people, and Danny's got to do a Kai massage thing get his chi on to put the traumatized victim at rest and stuff, while Luke deals with the heavy machinery. When they get to their employer's place of business, there's a whole bunch of truck drivers ganging up on the employer, and the problem is vanishing rigs.
I thought you were going to say the problem is that this art team does not think truck drivers are attractive people.
That's for sure. There's also this odd panel where they're like walking through the street, and there's this guy, and they're just talking to each other, and on the side there's a guy thinking, wait till I tell grandma who I saw in New York City. And I'm like, what? Was that like some sort of inside joke? Or seemed to take up a lot of real estate for no reason, you know?
My dad's color to the whole thing.
And that's actually Eddie Brock before he gets his symbiote.
He's just a country kid in the big city. Look who I saw, Ma. So Power Man and Iron Fist break up the truck drivers ganging up on the employer because, you know, with the logic of Danny's got this Eastern philosophy that violence leads to more violence. Here, let me show you. So Luke and Danny go undercover as truckers. This is like a 70s episode of, you know, an hour-long drama series. You know, all right, now the cast is going undercover as truckers.
I'm trying to remember when US 1 came out. Remember that comic, Steve?
Yeah, that has to be sometime around, or probably after this time.
Around that's that one of those America issues time. You always see in the 20 cent bin.
It didn't have like a Sienkiewicz cover though, or something. The first issue, there was some striking cover of like a Bob Larkin cover or something, or maybe I'm mixing it up with something else, like Crystar the Crystal Warrior or something.
To be fair, I don't remember US 1. I mean, I remember it existed, but I don't.
It could be the greatest comic ever. I could picture the guy with the red like Loverboy headband with the 80s look. Anyway, so Luke and Danny, they're the undercover truckers going on the road, you know. We got a big convoy. And they encounter some yokels at a truck stop. Bound to happen, right? Also, Luke, of course, takes his coffee black. Just to be provocative, you know. And while they're on their great big convoy, Luke's truck disappears. And so Iron Fist discovers this underground chamber under the road and follows. They're attacked by the Mole Man and Moloids.
Who doesn't dig the Mole Man?
See, the government contract that the trucking company guy had was to bring this machinery up to some government location. I'm thinking they're building Thunderbolts Mountain myself. And the Mole Man is hijacking the trucks and using the materials on them to build this very un-Mole Man-like technological base.
Wait a second, I think this is Thunderbolt's Mountain.
Luke finds the truckers and frees them.
You forgot the important part, Steve. His shirt gets all ripped up.
Oh, of course.
I was going to say, at least Luke's running around without a shirt, right?
While he's freeing the truckers, Danny is having to face off against the Mole Man. And if, I mean, I still can picture the panel-by-panel sequence of the Mole Man using his staff to kick the Fantastic Four's butt in Fantastic Four number one, you know, doing his moves. And so he's not a foe to be trifled with. So Danny has his hands full there. Luke also has to, like, lift this giant rock up so everyone can escape the lava, and then he's like left for dead and everything. But fortunately, Iron Fist wallops the Mole Man and frees Luke from a certain death in a lava chamber and everything, and they have a nice romantic ending.
And it's this next issue, Goldeneye. You mean that Goldeneye?
Dun dun dun.
I don't want to knock Denny and all, because I really like Denny, but some of the dialogue in here is, not only does he give all the yokels, like, we make fun of the French and German, but he gives them, like, yep, a weird hillbilly accent, and Luke has some weird turns of phrase, too, like, I don't know, like, when he's tired, he says, I'm whipped, and I'm like, does that mean the same thing that I don't know, it just seemed weird slang, maybe I'm forgetting the 80s.
Have you read Hard Traveling Heroes? I mean, I know it's a classic, and the Neil Adams, and the... I mean, that's one of my favorite aspects of DC Comics is the Green Arrow, Green Lantern, Black Canary thing. Around that time, the Denny O'Neil with Neil Adams, and then Mike Grell after that, too. But I don't know how long ago it's been since you've last read Hard Traveling Heroes, but Denny doesn't... some of the dialogue, the dialects he uses to portray the people as they're even, you know, the... anyway. I'm not surprised, let's put it that way.
Yeah, like I said, I mean, Denny's doing it, but yeah, you got to put yourself in the right mindset. But yeah, it's a great, the art team should be proud of themselves. Such detail and the sweat on Luke when he's moving the rock and the heat coming off. It's like you're right there in the lava pit.
Great fill-in issue for an art team. Issue 86 has writer Denny O'Neill joined by series penciler Dennis Cohen and Carl Potts doing the inking. I really like this team, Cohen and Potts. Like my favorite Power Man Iron Fist artists when I think of the title. I mean, it's Cary Gamille and Villamonte is what I think of first. I really like the Burn stuff as well. That kind of got things rolling and has that whole Iron Fist angle to it. And with Colleen and Misty and all, I really like Burn's whole handling of those characters and everything. But then it's Cohen and Potts. There's something about Potts' inks over Cohen that takes some of the sharpness off of Potts' pencils, especially as we see Cohen's style develop over time. But, you know, it also is very stylistic. That I've always liked Potts' stuff.
Hey, you get no argument from me.
Here, Power Man and Iron Fist are hired by Halliburton to protect a rock and roll star, Ripcord, as he and his entourage travel across the Northwest in a new Elmwood super train.
Oh, we had a truck last time. Now we got a train.
Yeah.
And Luke's been on the bus, so we just need a plane story, Steve.
And the Halliburton is the name of the, like, rock and roll guy's manager, which is odd. The opening sequence has Luke and Danny walking through town. And Luke gets, like, a cinder block dropped on his head. And I love the sequence. It just crumbles to dust over his noggin, right? But what I really like, too, is, like, the wonderful musculature and form work on, like, Danny's moves when he does his... This is what I like about the Cohen-Potts team. You can really see the bends of the body while still maintaining a form. It's not like all of a sudden it gets all wonky and it seems like the guy's got to have a dislocated hip to be able to have that leg wrap around behind that other structure. And they really, really are tight. Tight figure work. And so in this issue 86, we have the mysterious Goldeneye. Who we wouldn't see again until the 1995 James Bond flick, right? That was the first Pierce Brosnan one.
Well, hey, Marvel did all those James Bond adaptations. They were just ahead of the curve.
If only Coletta didn't ink, like, the last several of them. This mysterious Goldeneye fellow has been paid to make sure that this train never makes it to its location in the Northwest. And so Luke and Danny have to deal with a variety of threats that are trying to stop the train. We've got lone gunmen in the crowd. We've got sabotaged couplings that separate the train cars while they're moving. There's a knife attack on the engineer. And, of course, explosives on a chasm-spanning trestle.
You forgot the heavy-handed... Don't do drugs, kid message that was folded in.
Oh, yeah. The glam rocker Ripcord. He's like a narcissistic man-child who's all pepped up on goofballs. At one point, he just grabs a gun and he starts just, like, shooting wildly around the car.
You know, as you do when you take drugs.
Luke and Danny take out all the saboteurs. Sabotage. But in the end... this wasted, drugged-out rocker dude just leaps off a cliff and falls to his death. He, and I quote, he wants his train back. When the train falls into the chasm. By then, Luke actually puts the pieces together. He figures out that the train was actually the target, not Ripcord. The train was never going to make the trip successfully on its own, and Elmwood, the company that made the train, would have lost a whole bunch of money in government contract and all that stuff. So Power Man and Iron Fist head back to Elmwood's headquarters just in time, like right at the moment when Goldeneye is being paid off and being handed the money. So they're able to take him down. I mean, Goldeneye's got his Goldeneye power. Luke's all, you got a trick. Slime like you's always got a trick. Wham!
It's total James Bond because he's getting paid in diamonds. So it's a big sack full of diamonds.
Halliburton at the end tells the guys that he already somehow, and this is before the online world and MP3s and everything, somehow he's already pressed the, and this is even before like cassettes were big. This is still like, you know, 8-tracks are still trying to make a go of it, I think. No, it's mostly albums and some cassettes at this time. But he says that he's already put out the recording that, like, Ripcord made on the train, which was just, like, hours ago. And now it's already the greatest-selling recording in history.
Wow, some payola going on there.
It's already been pressed, distributed, sold, and the numbers are in. Crazy.
It got a lot of downloads, I hear, Steve.
Yeah.
That's how they knew.
Issue 87 has the same team, O'Neill, Cohen, and Potts. Love this art team.
And oh, did Luke push Moon Knight into a pool without, you know what he did to Danny before? Hey, yeah, you'll survive on your own. That's what the cover looks like.
Sometimes you just
one of those things.
You just got to fend for yourself. You got to swim.
Yeah, exactly.
It's up to you. It's
and that cape, you know, a cloak number doesn't seem to be helping Moon Knight there.
Well, as Kevin is suggesting, like Daredevil several issues ago, writer Danny O'Neill is bringing in another one of the characters that he edits. He edits the Daredevil book, and he edits Moon Knight. It's funny, too, because inker Carl Potts here is the guy who would later follow Sienkiewicz and O'Neill on Moon Knight, both editing and art-wise. Though I only think he drew a couple of issues, and then he just stuck to the edits and started passing the Bo Hampton and a couple other people doing the art. Anyway, I like that. This is a real iconic image of Carl Potts doing Moon Knight that is one of the licensed images that they use. I have it on a glass tumbler.
That's a nice opening splash there.
Yeah, I love it. And I love the moon, you know, the cape being the full moon and
yeah,
good stuff. Or that, not the full moon, but the crescent moon. So anyway, a massive heat wave is in New York City, and that's really overriding this whole issue. It's really everyone dealing with the heat. Moon Knight's chasing this crook up a fire escape to the brim of this water tower that is familiar to the crook, and the crook pulls out a gun and shoots Moon Knight as he's diving to the guy, and they both fall in, and the water tower's empty, so they both clonk. And they're both injured and unconscious, and the sun's beating down. They're out of it and trapped.
I'm concerned about that guy's leg, though. Like, it just looks awkward.
Yeah, well, it's not going to work out great for him, Kevin.
Yeah.
Spoiler. I just love the repeated, how they do the sun felt very Sienkiewicz, just these concentric sort of off-kilter circles to be like, that's the sun.
Cohen has a very Sienkiewicz-y type of style as he's finding his ground, for sure. So Moon Knight's all super hot. He's got an injured knee, shoulder, and head. The crook is dead. He can't get out. He's just getting hotter. He's just getting weaker. Marlene, who is Moon Knight's girlfriend, and Frenchie, who is his pilot and partner, hire Power Man and Iron Fist to find him because he's been missing for 2 days.
See, this is proof that he isn't Batman, because otherwise he'd be like, well, let me check my 50 compartments here for...
I thought it was because he had people that loved him.
Well, ouch. What's funny, though, is he does try to rely on some of his technology. He's thinking, oh, I can broadcast my voice with my cowl mic that he uses to communicate with Frenchie up in the helicopter, right? So he's like, where is it? It's not around his neck, and he looks up, and it's caught. It had broken free of his costume. It had caught on a little piece of metal that was coming out of the rim of the water tower. And he makes a desperate throw with one of his crescent darts and manages to knock it down to himself, but it's damaged. It's the thing that blocked the gunshot. So I thought that was a nice way to take that Deus Ex Machina away from him, basically, and explain why he didn't get, you know, it's the old, the bullet just grazed him. Well, this at least makes sense. The bullet hit him pretty square on, but it just hit the
why did
cowl mic.
What I couldn't figure out was Marlene wears a veil?
Well, she's trying to hide her appearance so that they can't track Moon Knight's identity to her and Stephen Grant, who is his Bruce Wayne-ish type persona.
The clear veil sort of just made me wonder, like, what? Is that some weird affectation? Do we need to get Andrew Shaw on the phone to go through Marlene's wardrobes?
They went out of there. That's funny. Someday we'll get on that, because there's a thing where they did, like, Marlene fashions in the back of one of the issues of Moon Knight where you could, like, draw in fashions. But they did go out of their way to explain that they were trying to be anonymous, and even at the end he's, like, taken away in an anonymous car kind of thing, that sort of business. But anyway, so here we get Power Man and Iron Fist stepping into Moon Knight's world a little bit, which was cool. First crossing paths with Marlene and Frenchie, and then, I mean, you don't get Gina at the diner or anything, but you do get Crawley, who is one of Moon Knight's street informants, who is a very well-spoken, you know, street person, always has a lot of flies flying around him. So they learn from Crawley that Moon Knight was investigating the Planet Gang. I'm thinking they're environmentalists. Seems obvious.
Captain Planet.
Is that where you went?
Captain Steve.
So,
with our powers combined.
So Power Man and Iron Fist, make a long story shorter, they take down the Planet Gang as they were loading their submarine. The best.
What?
The fight with Iron Fist and the Fat Captain is great. I mean, I'm obviously for the fat guy, but still, that was a pretty sweet fight.
Well, not Captain Planet. Commodore Planet. Yeah, that was cool. He was like a Kingpin-y type character, which obviously O'Neill is familiar with from Daredevil, that he says that, you know, you turn your iron fist rigid, I can do that with my whole body. He's like a big fat cobra. There's no word on Moon Knight, though, even after taking down this Planet Gang, until that crook that Moon Knight was initially chasing, the dead one with the leg that's not in a good position, his wife spills the beans on the husband's water tower hiding spot, where he took some money from Commodore Planet and stashed it. Aha. Now Power Man Iron Fist can follow that lead, but by then the heat wave has broken with torrential rains, and now Moon Knight is drowning, and just as he's going to go under, he gets pulled out by Danny. Yay. Moon Knight's going to live.
That's good.
Yeah, I thought it was a fun one and done. What's not to like?
I was totally digging Moon Knight at the time, so I really liked that they crossed over, and I was digging out Power Man and Iron Fist, and this was a fun way to have a Marvel team up that didn't have Spider-Man or The Thing in it, which is pretty much all we got back then, unless they had these types of crossovers. And it totally worked as a Power Man and Iron Fist story, another case, you know? Issue 88 is written by Danny O'Neill, with pencils by Dennis Cohen, and inks by diverse hands, which, to me, my eye, certainly included Ernie Chan, and I'm afraid for several pages, Vinny Coletta, and Steve Mitchell, to finish things up. The cover, I really like this Dennis Cohen cover, even though it is completely backgroundless, and the background cover is a stark red that isn't very pleasing to the eye. But Luke is throwing a telephone pole, like, at the reader, and I particularly like his zip-toned pants.
It looks like an airplane or something.
Yeah, that's how it's flying through that's how it's been launched, like a biplane. So DW, who is Luke's pal, who runs the Gem Theater that Luke has his living quarters and private office on the top floor of, DW is having a party upstairs at the Gem, right above where Luke lives, but they're all taking bad acid and, like, jumping off the roof and stuff.
Well, even better, Steve, this is one that kills you after you use it once.
Well, that's right.
So, you know, it's a real popular type of drug.
If you survive that. Well, it's a misformulated drug, we learned. So if it's not like this is the what's going around, this is just this batch. So if, you know, you survive the desire to jump off the roof, then it kills you within a few hours, so on its own.
I mean, look, kids, don't do drugs, but could they write a comic that at least vaguely resembles some sort of drug that exists?
like with Angar the Screamer, that was probably a better depiction of taking psychedelics. But anyway, so where's DW, though, with this party going on, people jumping off the roof and Luke having to catch him and stuff? Well, DW had a fight with his girl, and he split. He split, but he had a dose of the bad acid with him. Didn't take it, but he had it with him. Luke immediately wants to go after his friend. That's all that matters. Save his friend. Save DW. And Danny pulls the, you know, more rational needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few or the one type shtick, and seeks to get to the supply of the bad dope, you know, at its source, and try to save many lives. What I like about this, though, why I mention that, is that I like, this is the friendship piece of Power Man and Iron Fist that I really like that has developed across the book. They basically agree to disagree and completely respect each other's priorities, and they each head off to do their separate thing to attack this problem from both ends. Luke's going to go after DW. Iron Fist is going to go after, you know, the drugs. And takes a cab.
Whoa, who's that cab driver?
It's Jake Lockley's cab, who is another one of Moon Knight's personas that he uses. And Moon Knight is happy to assist Iron Fist, as he thinks to himself, because you just pulled me out of a water tower filling with water last week.
Now, can we count this as a Moon Knight cameo, even though Moon Knight never actually appears as Moon Knight?
And also, I have to say, you know, I suggested that it was a bummer that there's a bunch of Coletta pages in here. What's interesting, though, in looking at them, is that he uses a lot of Zipitone this issue. I don't know if there was like a sale on Zipitone, because it's like on the cover, and it's, there's a lot of it in there. But sometimes he uses it, Coletta uses it to, like, to really great effect. Like the thing with where he's got smoke kind of going in front of them, so that it looks like it's hazy behind them and in front of them, but you can still sort of see through the haze to see that there's form under there. I mean, this is Coletta. He could have just skipped having anything go in front of them and taken the easy, you know, where his reputation is to take the easy way out. And there are times where I thought he took the time. And there are some, both pages and panels, that are the usual Coletta fare, but there are also some here that are really nice. There are even panels on a page where it's like there's a panel that's really nicely done. He does a lot to the face or to the arm or to whatever, but then you look at the rest of the page and you look, that's where he spent all his time. Anyway, it's not all bad, folks. Danny's trail leads him to the drug traffickers. It is a villain from Iron Fist number 5 and a villain from Luke Cage Heroes for Hire number 5 who have teamed up. Isn't that funny? The two villains from each of their own issue number 5s. It's the blade-wielding Scimitar and the poison-knitting-needle-carrying Black Mariah. So, Iron Fist, he pretty easily takes down Scimitar, despite the fact that Scimitar has been, like, training for months against Iron Fist's specific moves. It's still not, no, not gonna happen.
Well, I also like how Luke just isn't afraid to punch. Because sometimes they get a little weird when it's mixed gender heroes, but
That Luke just... Well, he has to. He's dealt with Black Mariah before, not like Iron Fist, because remember how I said that knitting needle was poisoned? Out goes the fist. And then, like, practically out the window, Luke is just happens to be walking by and catches Iron Fist falling out of the window. Then Luke sort of does the move on the cover and throws a lamppost at Black Mariah and Scimitar's getaway car, and easily takes down Scimitar and Black Mariah with a few punches, like you said, Andrew. Then it's off to save DW, who didn't really need saving thanks to a non-drug-induced hallucination. Wasn't that weird?
Wait, I thought that guy was real.
Or was he? Who was he? There was some weird, cloaked, anonymous figure who pays DW a visit on the bridge and gives him some insightful, helpful information and then disappears as quickly as he appeared, and DW questions whether it was real at all. But it's what saves
John
him.
John Constantine.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, this one, I don't know, I feel like you could, if you had to pick one of these to skip, this would have been the one. But like I said, I get tired at the poorly executed message comics.
Yeah, my vote is for 91 for the skip one, the fill-in issue. But we'll get to that. Issue 89 is also Denny O'Neil and Denny's Cohen and Carl Potts is back. This issue has a leader of... This is so funny. This leader of a military unit of mercenaries, he interrupts Luke and Danny's dinner. Well, it's the pre-dinner cocktail. Luke is going to have dinner with Harmony, his girl, his high-maintenance girl. And this military guy just interrupts Luke and Danny sitting there having a drink with gunfire, saying, like, I don't know how you find me, but you'll never take me in. And they're like, who? And then they take him in. And then he commits suicide in his cell for being beaten by a black guy and then a single white guy.
Why can't more bad guys do that, right, Steve?
It's like, this guy was so pathetic. And then, to follow suit, the mercenaries unit, this mercenary guy who commits suicide after giving himself up, basically, for no reason, his unit then make it their mission to take down those who so obviously are to blame for their leader's death, right? Power Man and Iron Fist. It's all their fault. As ridiculous as the premise is, what's cool is it's a bunch of mercenaries trying to take down Power Man and Iron Fist. So, that's fun.
And it's really, the action is very good in this. I mean, it's good in all of them, but this one I felt really, I don't know, the 80s and a paramilitary group and everything, and just felt like, yeah, this is comics.
And I hope they don't damage the soda machine or anything.
I also like the, funny you should say that, but I also got to mention while we were talking about this opening scene too that it's great. Harmony shows up for dinner with Luke after they've been shot up and taken down this guy, and she's like all mad at him because his you know shirts and tatters. This is how you show up for dinner. That's Harmony. One team of these, you know, this crack squad attack Luke at the gym with automatic weapons armed with armor-piercing bullets. And Cage uses a fridge as a shield to slow down the velocity of the bullets, but they still hurt when they go through the... But you're right, Kevin. I thought the same thing. I really would have liked to have seen O'Neil pay homage to the, you know, to the history of the series, which is now on issue 89, for crying out loud, and he should have used the soda machine instead of some fridge. Then Cage could have muttered some kind of line about how the soda machine has had it in for me since day one, since I moved here, and now here it is saving my life, or something to that effect. You know what I mean?
That would have been good.
Missed opportunity. So that was Luke's deal. Now we've got Danny avoiding a, like, a wired door trap at his office. And he's got a cool move. He does this window-to-window move on to the exterior of the building, window-to-window. Then in this sequence that I really enjoyed, Danny bursts through the window of the sabotage door to keep Luke from opening it. And poor Luke, he's just like going to the office, right? He's like about to grab the knob, and Danny comes shooting through the glass, tackling Luke, glass shooting all over the place, and Luke's like, I can hardly wait. And then the next panel caption box begins, one explanation later. You know, it's like, he's like, Lucy, you got some explaining to do. But these are those kinds of moments that continue to both play on and build the friendship here between these two characters.
Also, they strategize. You know, they always split up the team, and one guy goes one way and one goes another. They, you know, they're not just interchangeable cogs. They're each their own character.
There's also some individual pages strewn throughout this issue that are obviously not Cohen and Potts. And what they look like is they look like Greg LaRocque tryout pages. He's going to be the penciler on this book after 100. So I'm wondering, he's uncredited, of course, and it has a real clean look. It's not Coletta, though, although it almost looks it in some places. But my guess would be LaRocque. These mercenaries, they storm a building and take hostages and say Power Man and Iron Fist have to show up. It's a big standoff. And they do, and they fight their way to the command central. Guys are all behind it all, but by the time they get there, they've all locked themselves in a vault and taken cyanide and die. You know, so their deaths could be meaningful. Because their cause was so worthy and great.
Hey man, you don't mess with whoever these mercenaries are that I've never heard of and will never hear of again.
It's like a Monty Python thing where they like all like pull out their swords and then stab themselves or something. You know, it's like
the crack suicide squad.
Issue number 90. Well, here's a Dennis Cohen Bill Sienkiewicz cover. We've been comparing them. Now you get to see him teamed up.
Oh, Eunice. No one can touch him. Don't touch that.
Here, O'Neill has switched back to editor with issue 90, and this issue serves as the tryout issue for potential new writer Kurt Busiek, with art by Dennis Cohen and inks by Mel Candido, who around this time I remember from doing like the Robert E. Howard books, like some inks on Conan and Kull and that kind of a thing. His inks are heavy, like Ernie Chan heavy. It doesn't always look like Cohen, but it doesn't look bad.
No, I thought it was maybe a little bit tighter.
Right, yeah.
But some of the figure work is a little wavy, not wavy, but less precise, I would say.
Here, Power Man and Iron Fist are shown this, like, and it's used as a way to, Busiek is reintroducing all of the major concepts in the book, and as our way of getting to see who Power Man and Iron Fist are and what they do, we get to, over Power Man and Iron Fist's shoulder, watch a braggadocious, flamboyant draft commercial that is being shown to them by Jaren, who is their business manager type person. And so he's being introduced as well, reintroduced. And Cage just splits. He prefers clientele like a poor kid running up to him with a nickel, telling him his dad's store is being held up by Eunice the Untouchable.
Well, to be fair, you had a feeling that Luke wasn't expecting it to be that difficult, though.
No. No, it's just some guy's robbing my dad's store. We're the ones who know it's Eunice the Untouchable.
Wait, is that Pops?
Are they in Riverdale?
But no, I was thinking of... I keep on being reminded of the Netflix series.
What I like, too, here, though, like I was saying, is that Busiek is reintroducing the major settings and characters and cast of this series. Bringing back in Jaren. There's a cameo from the office manager, Jenny, and she's named. We get to see Misty Knight and Colleen Wing quick. You get to see that Harmony is there, and her face is healed up. Busiek makes the point to mention that she's got her bandages off from having been scarred up by who's the Constrictor's sidekick again?
I don't. He was a character we never saw again, Steve.
Snaggletooth? Sabretooth. You see DW, Solace on the street, and Busiek includes a Coke machine gag, too. You know? Hire the guy, I say. And
yeah, he knows his stuff.
And just when I was complaining about the lack of how they missed an opportunity for the Coke machine gag, Busiek throws it in here. Power Man and Iron Fist confront Eunice, having committed this crime here, and Luke and he kind of have a standoff. They are like breaking things over each other's heads and both just standing tall with good posture. Danny can't find any like kung fu pressure points or anything, or you know, he's trying to do like the Karnak thing on Eunice and find where the weakness is, and there is no weakness. And instead Danny gets really smashed against a brick wall hard head first by Eunice. And for you those don't know, Eunice is an early X-Men villain who has a force field around him that shortly after this issue, the force field starts becoming stronger and out of control, but here it's still something that is malleable that he can control, and nothing
can
touch
him. That was so great where the blob has to feed him and everything.
Yeah, he has to fight his way through. Yeah, wasn't that a Marvel fanfare, I think, where they did that, explored that? That was really cool. Anyway, also, Danny, when he gets smashed against the brick wall, he has a vision of Kun Loon, which reintroduces that aspect of Danny's life to help develop this subplot that's going to lead to issue 100. So Busiek's doing a lot of not world building, but bringing you back to the world and resetting the world here.
Stuff like that gets my attention.
Exactly. And as a reader, as a kid, that's the stuff that I was... I loved all this in-between and the character moments and everything, but that was the stuff that kept me dying for the next ish, to see what was going on with that.
You know what else gets my attention? These vertical panels with this incredible tunnel.
That's cool. Luke gives Chase down a sewer. He can't fit down the sewer, so he busts open the top of the sewer and just jumps down the tunnel itself. Very cool panels. Very Frank Miller-ish in the way they were laid out. Eunice loses Luke in the sewers. And so back home, they're licking their wounds and stuff, and Danny's recuperating. And then they go after Eunice and confront him on the street. DW is calling it High Noon in Times Square because it's a big face-off.
Nice panel of him sitting his chin on his knuckles.
Luke pounds away at Eunice completely unsuccessfully. But the Iron Fist packs a pretty good punch on Eunice. And I like how Busick explains that matchup. You know, that Eunice can do this all day, whereas Iron Fist depletes his chi with each move. So even though that hurt, he's like, I'm betting you can't keep that up. And he's right.
Yeah, as you get older, Steve, your chi doesn't recoup as fast.
Luke picks up Eunice by his force field. Interesting move. Then Eunice broadcasts what he's going to do, and then does it. But thankfully, because he broadcast, he told us what he was going to do first, Iron Fist could quickly make a plan. And the behavior that Eunice engages in that gives Iron Fist this very small opening is that since Luke hasn't picked up, he turns off his force field, allowing him to drop to the ground, when then he'll turn it back on. And in that space of the drop, Iron Fist kicks him out cold.
But I will say, it was believable for me, because Eunice is so arrogant that, like, he's told, because normally he doesn't get affected unless you got mental power, so I can completely see him feeling imperious and monologuing. It doesn't seem out of character for that guy.
And in the end, Luke and Danny earn their nickel. Issue 91 is totally a fill-in issue. That, this one would be my vote of the one to skip of this bunch. Written by Stephen Grant. And this seems to serve as kind of a full issue tryout for LaRocque. Greg LaRocque. Mm.
Is that the Kingpin on the cover?
And like I said, LaRocque will become the penciler on the book during Owsley's run after 100. This issue is more Cold War antics. As a female super spy, super talented, not super powered, she sets up Power Man and Iron Fist and gets them involved in this federal caper to capture a KGB agent, Skarkov. And no, he doesn't have a scar.
Aww.
I thought for sure he's going to have a big scar.
Does he get a scar?
I'm not saying this. It has some problems, but the exchange alone, where finally someone calls out Luke with his 300 pounds of muscle with a humorous line. I mean, that was worth it alone for this.
Noted. Fair enough. The feds hire this slick female spy in front of Power Man and Iron Fist. And this is what Luke seemed a little out of character here. He gets a little too much ego pride. Like, this city is our turf. I don't want no spy working my neighborhood. I want back at her because she got the better of me, and anything she can do in this city, I can do better and faster, and it's, I don't know.
Well, I think he didn't like, they were embarrassed by the nun. She was the nun, and that they fell for it completely. I think it's just his pride being like, they can't believe they fell for the fake nun bit.
But Luke and Danny do make good. They capture Skarkov, and they take his place at this posh ball. And Luke's cover gets blown by Stoneface, the main villain of the piece. And Danny...
Can't wait for him to come back.
Danny and Luke have to fight these African sumo warrior types. And they are tough foes. Two tough foes. And that's where you get...
Maybe you didn't catch the name. Luke Cage, 300 pounds of solid muscle. And then he gets punched in the stomach, and the guy just says, 400 pounds.
Nice.
And he is huge, too. I just thought that was, because, you know, while I love this era, when you read a bunch of these in a row and they're always resetting the table, you do get a little tired of the 400, 300 pounds of muscle and steel hard skin.
These two guys, like I said, they're tough foes. Iron Fist uses the Iron Fist and actually punches this guy in his fist. Like, I'm surprised he didn't vaporize the guy's hand, but it totally, like, puts him into a trauma shock and like, knocks him out cold. I mean, he must have shattered the guy's forearm. It turns out in the end that the spy chick is a double agent, and she let Skarkov go, and she was using Power Man and Iron Fist to find Stoneface and take him down, and then she gets all the credit and all the money, and they don't even get their cut of it, because actually she hired them that morning via Jenny at the office, Jenny on the block. So, unbeknownst to them, they were working for her. Jumps. Yeah. Anyway. All right, but issue 92 is Kurt Busiek is back. Now he's the regular writer, and we have Dennis Cohen and Mel Candido again.
Oh, look who's on that cover, too.
This is going to be Kevin's favorite issue.
I like some Hammerhead.
Luke and Danny are hired to protect a prison transit truck that is carrying mob boss Hammerhead to a remote upstate facility.
Oh, it's playing at the jam as well.
Hammerhead is... he's insisting that he's going to be broken out en route. And his buddies certainly try. I mean, first you get a gang of armed thugs that hold up the truck. Luke and Danny have to take him out. Then Man Mountain Marco and the Eel get dropped by helicopter onto the truck. They give Luke and Danny a run for their money. Until Power Man and Iron Fist do the classic move.
You gotta switch them?
Yeah, you gotta switch opponents. Lastly, Power Man and Iron Fist get thrown clear of the truck as it starts, like, shaking and practically turns itself over, doing, like, a barrel roll, plummeting off of an embankment. Because Hammerhead got free of his bonds all that time inside the truck while they were dealing with these other threats, and started pounding away at the inside of the hull, and managed to tip the truck and break it open, and now Hammerhead is free. But, sorry folks, there's only one more page to resolve this in the issue, so Hammerhead simply turns around to flee Power Man and Iron Fist and realizes he's actually running at the... he's right at the front gates of the very prison facility he was being delivered to. Wah, wah.
Wah, wah.
Yeah. But Busiek again takes his opportunity in his second issue here to get the book back to its roots and start developing some subplottage. Cage identifies again with being a ex-con and, you know, goes through some of that inner pain. We get Bob Diamond and Colleen sparring and then starting to neck. Haven't we seen that before? They start sparring and then they're kissing. We get to see some of the dynamic of Harmony and Misty living together and how that's probably not so much fun for Misty. Oh, and while Power Man and Iron Fist are on the truck, traveling upstate, they pass some kooky, coon loony structure that turns out to be some sort of oriental spiritual retreat, like monastery place. The truck driver calls it a fortune cookie resort. That was an interesting, because, you know, remember how I said Danny, when he got his bell rung in the last issue, he had like a vision of Kuun Loon. So he sees, like, as they come around a bend, like over this mountain pass, he sees this Kuun Loony looking structure, and he thinks it's a vision again. And then Luke makes a comment, "Oh, that's a weird building." He's like, "Oh, you see it too? Whew, you know, good thing."
We're both crazy.
I don't think anything's going to come of it, Steve. I wouldn't worry about it.
Oh, but it is. But it is. That's the whole thing. We're getting back to what will be the sequel to issue 75, where the gang will get back to a Kuun Loon related mystery and crises threat type of a thing in the big issue 100.
But what if he only would have done that one issue? He didn't come back, and then people would be like, well, that was some weird vision that never went anywhere.
Yeah. This is Jim Shooter era Marvel. This stuff doesn't happen. He's running a tight ship. But that's Power Man and Iron Fist, 85 to 92. We're close. This was the penultimate. There's a comic book word for you if you ever heard it. That's the penultimate Power Man and Iron Fist segment, because I'm going to need to be desperate for some more Power Man and Iron Fist to go back and revisit after issue 100. Although maybe just for the train wreck of it, we'll do it sometime, but not anytime soon.
Well, we have more Power Man showing up in Thunderbolts.
That's right.
So
we'll just
yeah.
Move to that. It'll be a lateral shift. Speaking of which, next episode, more Thunderbolts, right? Let's do that. And also, Andrew, I want to finish reading. I got to be honest. I never have read completely the original Machine Man series. And you said you were reading that trade. And I have that trade.
Yes.
And I want to finish reading it. And maybe we could talk about it next episode along with the Thunderbolt stuff.
Sure. That sounds good. That'll spur me on. I've been enjoying it, but I should finish that off.
And that's the type of kooky thing that's only going to be fun to talk to you guys about. You know what I mean?
I hear some jack-o'-lantern shows up in that book.
Ditko, too, right?
Yes, I remember that. I remember that when it came out. I haven't read it since then, but that is burned into my little pea brain.
So that'll be next episode, and then in episode 299, we'll have this last Power Man and Iron Fist segment going from 93 to 100, or maybe 101, because I think that's actually Busick's last issue. I got to check again. And then we'll have Marvel Noise episode 300, guys, where we'll have coverage of every Marvel issue 300.
That list gets smaller and smaller with each anniversary.
All right, guys, thanks for joining us this episode. And I look forward to hearing about your upcoming con adventures. Also, check us out over on Indie Comic Book Noise, where we'll get the train rolling over there again. All right, so until we trade in our Comic Cons for Fortune Cookie Resorts, they can find Marvel. Later. I took a freedom. You took a flag. I took a revolution. I'm trying to break. As the decibels of this disenchanting discourse continue to dampen the day, the conflicts again and again and again and again, as our sanity walks away. All this discussion, Lord, the political ego. Him quite erect. As the final sunset rose behind the earth, the clock is finally dead.